From the Marquee Media Studio inside Mark Tank, it's the Mark Haney Show.
Yes, this is the Mark Haney Show on a mission to ignite an entrepreneurial revolution right here in the hometown we love. And we do that by building the Backyard Advantage, the most connected community in the world for local entrepreneurs. It's based around this culture of love, right? Helping one another. So if you like our content, and you're going to like today, by the way, like and subscribe on YouTube or your podcast channel. Today we are really going to have a guest that's got a unique set of experience and skill as it relates to business, but also as it relates to sports. We know there's such a parallel when it comes to athletics and winning in athletics and development, as well as developing and becoming a winning entrepreneur or small business person. So we'll talk a little bit about that. He's also a successful business person. So anyway, without further ado, I want to introduce you, Billy Horton. He is the manager, assistant GM of the Yuba Sutter High Wheelers. He's a former professional baseball player. He coached at the big league level, at the major league level, as well as in the farm system. And we're lucky to have you on the show today. Thank you.
It's great to be here.
Okay, so I want to talk about the core principles that every coach needs on and off the field, because I imagine you've developed a framework of some sort. But if we do, maybe we'll just, before we get into the details of how to do it, maybe just a little bit more of your background. I know I sort of glossed over it a little bit, but how do you describe yourselves when somebody says, "Hey, who's Billy Horton?"
I'm the youngest of eight, of Tom and Patricia, in West Branch, Michigan, which I'm very fond of. It was a one-stop light town. And I moved to Arizona in eighth grade, and then went to high school out there, went to college out in Alabama, moved around. I've been everywhere except for Kansas and Hawaii, which is very random, the center of the country and about as far west as you can get. I got a chance to play pro ball, play collegiately. I was a kid who got cut in high school, so it's always been about overcoming adversity with me. It's something I speak on a lot. My freshman year, a gentleman named Dudley Butts, who's a good man, but he just told me I was good at everything and great at nothing. And I just decided, okay, I got to get better. So I worked my tail off. I found the weight room, and I worked harder at my craft. I went from being this little league MVP in Michigan to a nobody in Arizona, and I realized how good people were and how hard I had to work. So that turned into the high school career, into the college career, into the pro career playing. And then after done playing pro ball, I got into coaching, and then started my own business in 2006 called Cactus Athletics. And I was telling you off the air, over 10,000 people later, kids and coaches have gone through our program. Everything from coaching clinics to player clinics to baseball leagues that we've helped establish in Arizona and run. And then getting an opportunity to coach in the minor leagues with the Giants, like you talked about, having a chance to be a part of two World Series championships on the so in the minor leagues, I was a coach, but at that major league level, we won two World Series. We won a minor league championship when I was down in Arizona. Very successful throughout the minor leagues with our teams. Great players make you look good as a coach. Been in the playoffs a lot in the minor league level, won championships at that level as well. Again, crediting all my staff and my players for how they helped me. Been through a lot of adversity as well, and actually written two books, both been published. One was published in 2012 after the first World Series, and the second one was just published this year. So yeah, I've got a lot going on, a lot of different things, a wonderful wife and two boys, Connor and Bryce, my wife, Talleen. So they make me stronger. And I guess I kind of like when I played, I was a utility player. I played every position. If you count high school, college, and pro ball, I've played all nine positions at that level combined. And kind of how I am as a person too, a business owner, an author, and a pro baseball coach.
Well, yeah, you described before the show a little bit of what's going on in your life. So you are in the Marysville area now, I take it, in terms of living there. Is that right?
For the summer.
And then one of your kids is up in Reno playing in a tournament, a baseball tournament.
Yep.
The other one's here doing something else related to sports. And somebody gave them a ride over there. And so you borrowed a car and you got here. You fought the traffic and you got to me. I appreciate you doing that. But yeah, it can be hectic, I imagine, with everything you have, all the irons in the fire. It looks like you've gotten really good at relying on other people to sort of be part of that support system.
Yeah, it's being a master of efficiency. I learned that early on. When I started my business in 06, that was my lifeblood as far as income. That's how I helped pay the bills next to my wife, and as she worked for our church. And then when the Giants hired me in 2012, I had to learn how to be very, very efficient, still be a great husband, a great father, running a business full time and being a professional baseball coach and making sure that business didn't get in the way of my job with the Giants. So I learned to be very efficient starting in 2012. And then now also, learning about delegating, but also developing. John Maxwell is someone who I love a lot. He's someone I haven't met in person, but read a lot of his books. And for me, he talks about the three D's of delegating something, a task. And the first one is dumping. And that's just, I don't want to deal with it. So I dump it on this guy. Delegating, I thought, was a very positive thing. However, he talks about how if you delegate something to someone and they don't do it up to the par that you want, it falls on you, not on them, because the third D is developing. So it's delegating something to someone, but then teaching them how you want it done. So that dump, delegate, and develop, as I've been trying to be more of a developer. And then I added a fourth one, is discipleship. And that's when I'm developing someone and they want to hear about my faith and they want to be a part of that and grow in that aspect of their life. Then we add that, my fourth D of discipleship.
And is the discipleship, I have to imagine this, the three D's, the four D's, it is applicable in any walk of life. And the discipleship, I have to imagine that's even helpful for if you're coaching a young man or a young woman how to play sports. You want them to end up sharing their wisdom or their belief system with others if they think it'll be helpful.
Yeah, for sure. Again, I think that development piece is that. The discipleship part is just a matter of you get to know someone and they know I'm a Christian and then they say, okay, well, I want to learn more about that. So I never push that on anybody. I have a really great story. My first year with the Giants, Brock Bond was a middle infielder and he played up at, I think, the AAA level at that point. I was just a new coach. I was only there for about a month or so. Not many guys were there yet at the spring training facility. It was not, we weren't starting until mid-February. This was January. So I'm on my third week and, Brock walks up to me, he goes, "What's different about you?" And I'm like, "What do you mean?" He goes, "Something's different about you. You don't talk the same way as other coaches. You don't act the same way." And I'm like, "Well, I'm a Christian. I go to church." And he goes, "I knew it." And the thing was, I wasn't wearing a cross. He didn't identify me as a Christian by an emblem I wore or a t-shirt I wore. He identified me because he saw something inside me. He saw the way that I acted and that was attractive to him. So for me, I'm all good on everybody wearing crosses and shirts and all that and the garb that's out there, the cool t-shirts and everything. But I have not worn a cross to this day because I want people to identify me as a Christian through the way that I act. So our players, they know that I, but my backer, they know who I am, but I don't ever push my relationship with the Lord on anybody. I think that discipleship piece is where they know about my faith and they want to learn more about it. But I think I agree with you as far as like the, developing someone, it doesn't have to be a faith thing. It's about helping them become better as people and then they can pass on to the next generation.
All right, well, let's talk a little bit more. Let's dive a little bit more into developing, people that want to improve. And so I'm wearing my shirt. We talked about it. You knew the name of the shirt I bought it or the place I bought it at. I bought it in Scottsdale. So when I knew you had spent time in Scottsdale, I decided to put this shirt on today and it's rubbed dirt on it. And it's I bought it at a baseball clothing store. What's it called?
Baseballism.
Baseballism.
They have some
right.
great stuff.
It is really cool. I liked it because it said rub dirt on it. And as a baseball, football coach, entrepreneurial coach, it makes me, I really resonate with this saying, because I think a lot of times invariably we're going to have setbacks. You talked about your setbacks, not making the team. I have had tons of setbacks. Young people today that I coach in football, they're having setbacks, of course. And I think for a great leader, or excuse me, a good coach to help develop a player or an entrepreneur, sometimes we just have to let them experience the difficulty associated with the setback. And that's difficult. And many times they need to figure out a way to pick themselves back up. And rub dirt on it might be a little callous way of saying it, but it's kind of an old school way of saying, you know, you're not hurt, rub some dirt on and get back in the game. Because that's, I mean, ultimately, whether you rub the dirt on it or you ice or you go have your surgery or whatever you're going to have for your setback, you're going to need to get over it and get back on your feet at some level. And most of that's in your mind.
Yeah. So let me share a story with you. So in 2019 was my last year with the Giants. In 2018, our general manager, Bobby Evans, got let go. Amazing man. Love him. Still staying hunted to this day. And I'm so thankful that Buster Posey brought him back, and he's now a special assistant to the Giants, to Buster. And by the way, I think the Giants are back on track. You know, I didn't, people say, do you still root for him? I'm like, after 19 was tough. When they let me go, they let go. They had somebody else came into power, you know, and the way they ran it was different. They let go of a lot of us after the 19 season. I didn't get hired by a major league team after that, which I was shocked by that off season. And then in 2020, everyone got kicked below the belt by a terrible situation for the whole world, that we don't need to go into. But at that point, you know, everyone was hurting. I'm working for Uber Eats, and I'm working doing lessons. I'm working, trying to do whatever I can to make ends meet. And there's nothing wrong with that. It's just a matter of, you know, my pride was sitting there. Like, I got World Series rings in my office right now. I've got, you know, all this background, and I've got the same job as a high school kid, you know, driving for Uber Eats. It was a gut check. I was going through some really difficult and some dark days there in 2020 and some hard times. And my business was crushed. There was no business anymore. Cactus Athletics was toast. So you go from running a successful business. That was the joke with my wife and I, so we wouldn't cry. It was like, I went from running a successful business and being a professional baseball coach, and we were, you know, talking about how it was tough to have time for each other. And now we've got nothing but time, because the business is tanked and I'm unemployed. So you got to get back up. And that, what I went through was getting a job in 2021 in the MLB Draft League as a manager for a quarter of what I made from the Giants. So I still had to work two or three other jobs to make ends meet. And then 2022, turning down a chance to be a minor league coach in independent ball in New York as a hitting coach, to take a job as a field coordinator for a college wood bat league in Arizona, which was less than what I made the year before with Williamsport, but being home to be with my family. And then in 23, taking a job with the Billings Mustangs in the Pioneer League to be a manager, for still half of what the Giants used to pay me. And the season, we had a great team. Again, the players made us look good as coaches, went to the championship, lost to Ogden. Billings did not re-sign me, which I was a little shocked by, but then God steps in, and this new team, the Yolo Highwheelers, this ownership came in, brand new team for 2024. They tripled my salary, and they, all of a sudden now, I'm making more than what the Giants used to pay me, and I'm still coaching baseball, and I'm home more than what I would have been if I had to travel. Mm-hmm. And then the 24 team, again, an exceptional team. This time we go to the championship in our first year, and we win it. So again, great players make you look great as a coach. And I get another pay bump, and now we move from UC Davis, which was our home field, now to Bryant Field in Marysville. And I wrote my second book through all this time. And when you said the setback is what it made me think of, because the book is called Today, and not to be self-promotional, but Today is an acronym. And so the first five chapters of the book is each letter of the acronym Today, which is take action. And then O is overcome, D is dream, A is achieve, and Y is yes. And then chapter six is called the setback. And the setback is literally from 2019 through 2022, and then the comeback is chapter 7, and that is 2023 to 2024. So each basically what it does is it tells the story of how my business started, and I take people through basically these points of how my business started, and each chapter has bullet points of what to work on. It has study notes. You know, it tried to help you. How do I start a business? How do I build what I want to do? Is it a business, or is it just something I'm gonna you know, grow into as a person? I wanna be better. I wanna start a ministry. I wanna start a nonprofit. What do I wanna do? This is kind of a blueprint how I did it and how you can do it. But again, it came from when you said the setback. That was chapter mm-hmm. 6. And then it's encouraging because it's here's how I built the business. Now the business is not doing so great. Here's a setback, but every setback, everyone loves that comeback story. And that was 23 and 24.
You know, as you were describing the book, it made me think about this, I guess, dichotomy is the only word I can think of, where you use the word dream, which I'm a big dreamer. I paint these pictures of a backyard advantage, the most connected community in the world. And I have that in different aspects of my life, these sort of fantastical visions that you need to imagine. And yet knowing there's setbacks that are invariable. So I have this sort of way that I deal with it. And I also heard a song this morning, and I don't know if you're a country western fan or not, but there's a song by Thomas Rhett, and it's like, "What Can Go Right?" It's a brand new song, and the song says, "Think about what can go right." I think so many people out there, they really spend a lot of their time thinking about what could go wrong. You know that doesn't help build confidence if you're getting ready to get up and hit a baseball, for sure. You want to think about what's going to go right. You want to imagine what winning might look like, yet have this, I call it emotional insurance policy, knowing that you are going to have these setbacks that you can't predict. So I have this emotional insurance policy. I've been married 40 years to the same woman, and I have this belief that if I go back and just go, okay, what's my worst case scenario here? Is, hey, I lose everything and it's just me and her back in the duplex, back in the sexplex when we first got married, and I got a hot shower and the love of a good woman. I was as happy as I ever was in my life. And so it's like, if that's the worst case scenario I have to go back to, no problem. I can deal with it. And then I sort of compartmentalize that and then try to dream a little big and start chipping away at it. It's sort of my way of dealing with the uncertainties of life.
John Huizenga. So John Huizenga is a fantastic individual who I wanted to punch in the face when I first met him, because he was so positive, he drove me absolutely crazy. He's from Michigan, went to Michigan State. I'm a Michigan fan, but I hired him based on the fact that someone who I liked and respected recommended him to me. He became an outstanding coach and one of the best coaches I ever had, worked for us for Cactus. He was so positive, it had to be fake. Everything was so positive, and I'm like, your team stinks, and how is it you're still positive? These players aren't that good. He found the good in everything. And after a while, I'm like, I had to follow him. You know, he worked literally for me, but I was kind of watched him for a year, and I'm like, he made me a better person, because it changed the way I spoke. I was someone who every setback set me up for the next comeback, right? Getting cut from my high school team set me up for waiting for the next hard thing that happened, which was not getting drafted. And then I was able to overcome that and sign as a free agent. Not getting drafted set me up for when my career ended to move into a coaching career, right? And then then all that set me up for the next one, which was the bubble bursting in real estate in 2008, when I had four houses, when I was worth millions of dollars and I had four houses, and then I was worth $0 when all four went under. That set me up for the next setback, so the next comeback, all those things. And what John taught me was this, is it was just a matter of seeing the good in everything. So instead of saying, as a coach, and I really am big on this, instead of saying, "Don't worry about that," I say, "Focus on this." It's the same exact message in a positive way. and everything I talk about, I try to not use the word don't, never. There's phrases actually, again, it's one chapter in my book where I put like five different phrases where in everyday life, we look at the glass half empty side, or is it half full? And it's literally just the way that you speak life into things. And John spoke life into everything, including me. So for me, when I think about that, about being positive, it's a matter of your mindset and your perspective. And the perspective is this: okay, what have I gone through and how did I overcome it? I'm going to overcome the next thing. It's just a matter of being positive through it and thinking about instead of saying, oh, it's going to happen to me, it's happening again. No, it's okay. You're going through it, but thank God you're going through it, because you're not going to get stuck in the valley. Because with the valleys and the peaks, when you see a mountain range, you got valleys and you got mountaintops, right? Well, the water runs downhill. Most of the vegetation's in the valleys. You don't like being in the valley. You don't like being in a difficult spot, but that's where you grow. And there's sometimes where you need to be there for a while, and then you're pulled out of that, and then the mountaintops are great. So you want to try to live like this more, right? And you love to be on a plateau where it's always success. But there's going to be those valleys in life, and you have to have perspective and be positive, because you're going to get through it. You're going to get through it.
Turning these setbacks into fuel, I have to imagine getting cut or not getting the recognition that you deserve by getting drafted and these kind of things. It makes me think about the value associated with the setback as being fuel. Or if I'm coaching young men in football, and something doesn't go their way, the best thing to do is use that pissed offness and control it, right? Controlled pissed offness on a football field can be a great thing. It can bring out a different level of intensity, but it has to be controlled versus out of control, and which can happen in, for sure, in sports, but it can happen in business too.
Yeah. So it was funny because our assistant coach, AJ Crapo, who's fantastic. He does our analytics and handles some of our scouting. I've known him since he was probably 10 years old. So he worked with us now in Billings in 23. And in 24, he was with YOLO. Now he's with us in Yuba in 25. And he's funny because he's got this little niche. He's a music guy and he's a movie guy. And my younger son, Bryce, and I were in the car with him last night because my wife and Connor are at the baseball tournament in Reno. And we played this song, The Fruits of the Spirit. And it's like a cartoon song, and there's things bouncing around on YouTube. And AJ can't stand the song, right? And me and Bryce are just singing the top of our lungs, The Fruits of the Spirit. And one of them is self-control, mm-hmm. right? And, for me, you look at it from a man. I mean, I was a football player. I was a baseball player. I mean, I was 6'2", 215 pounds. I was whatever, 7-8% body fat. I was macho. I'm a guy. Like, I get it. But meekness, that sounds weak, but meekness, when you look it up, is strength under control. Like, as men, are we going to be defined by what society says? How much money we make? How many women we sleep with? What's our net worth? No. I've never seen once a U-Haul behind a hearse. Doesn't go with us. So what's your identity? If my identity is being a baseball player, when that goes away, who am I? Am I less of a person? I joke with my sister because she told me she was so happy when I found my wife, Tali. She goes, oh, you found someone to complete you. I'm like, this is not Jerry Maguire. Like, my wife does not complete me. I was like, she goes, well, Joe completes me. I'm like, well, that's great for you. I'm like, Tallinn compliments me in every way. I'm a man of faith. Jesus Christ completes me. My wife compliments me. If she were to die tomorrow, it would be awful. I would grieve. I'm not a half person if she's gone. I'm a whole person still in my faith. So for me, it's like I have a perspective of this self-control is something that I need to understand as a coach and as a player. Like, yes, you have that, what you talked about, that intensity. And when you take that intensity and you have self-control with it, now you're focused. It's like a laser. This light's lighting up the entire room, but when you focus it, it can pierce through steel. When you have that intensity and you can focus it on a young man like that out on the football field, he can do great things. When he's just everywhere and he's a psycho, he can get hurt. He can hurt other people. He can help. He can hurt the team. Like, it's that self-control and learning how to do that, and all that testosterone in a 16-year-old and trying to harness all that, and realizing too, it's hard being a teenager. I've got two teenage boys. So if you're a coach and you're listening to this, remember how hard the game was when you played it. So coach with some grace. Let them make mistakes. Don't just punish them with exercise because you're mad at him because he made a mistake. How many mistakes did you make when you played? I made a lot. So I'm not saying you got to pat him on the butt all the time. Sometimes you need to put your foot, I got size 15 feet. I got to put my size 15 in their rear end. But I also need to understand when to pat it too. So having that self-control as a player is also important as a coach.
So you're speaking to the coach now, and now let's speak to the parent for a minute, because it's been said that there's more helicopter parents out there today than maybe when I was a kid, maybe when you were a kid, and that, you know, the parents want to get involved every time their child has one of these, let's call it a setback, where they don't make the team or they don't get the position that they want to play. And as a parent, how should we be thinking in order for our child or our teenager to get the best experience out of that? When they have their setbacks, how do you handle it?
It's a great question. And the hard part about being a parent is you don't want to see your kid fail. And it's a hard part about being a coach. What I've learned is this. You touch a stove when it's hot. Touch it once and you don't touch it twice. You pee on an electric fence once. I grew up in the country. You don't do it twice, right? I don't want to see my kids fail. And the best way to learn about failure is to learn from someone else's failure. So listening to your parents, if I'm talking to kids right now, listening to them. But as parents, I'm in the same boat that if you're listening right now, you got to let them fail. And you have to understand when they do, just to be there to pick them back up. Because being a helicopter parent, you are debilitating your child. And my wife and I parent a little bit differently. I only had one rule growing up. I think my parents were tired. I mean, I'm the youngest of eight kids, right? They think my only rule was come home safe. Literally. I could come home at 10 p.m., at 2 a.m., they didn't care. It was just come home safe. But they trusted me. And with that, I didn't take it for granted. And I was a pretty good kid. So I didn't get into trouble, right? I think kids are getting into more trouble when their parents are always on top of them, because you have Life 360 on them. I get it. You always want to track and see where they're at, because there's more people out there. I mean, we're in Arizona. There's people stealing kids, you know, 3 hours. We're 3 hours away from the border. It's right. Terrible. It's sickening. So I get that you want to protect your kids. But do you want them to be on your basement or in your fourth bedroom until they're 25 because they can't make eggs because you're doing it for them when they're 17 years old? Like, at some point, letting them have responsibility is a huge thing. Giving them chores at a young age is a smart thing to do. You only got to pay them a buck to do it. My mom paid me in baseball cards. She went to the dime store. They were cheap and expensive. And she flipped me a pack of baseball cards for mowing the lawn or something like that. So for me, it's like, my kids learned the value of a dollar when they were 8, 9, 10 years old. You know, my son Connor now, he's been working the past 3 years as a bat boy. He's got 5, 6 grand in the bank. You know, he's been saving his money. So for me, yes, the helicopter parent, I understand. I don't want to see my kids get hurt. I don't want to see them fail. But if you don't allow them to do that, they will not become responsible adults. And we're trying to raise the next generation of adults who will take care of us when we're older.
For sure. All right. So I'm going to sort of play off of the child development or young person development kind of messaging in thinking about watching major league sports specifically. And we can talk baseball or really almost any sport that I can recall watching. There's really a problem with sportsmanship at the pro level. And I say that in that it's not a problem for me. It's these people get put on the pedestal for our young people, and we see some of their actions, and then we see it emulated on the Little League field or or in high school, and I assume you probably see it in the minor leagues as well, is these things that are, I guess, accepted in a lot of, you know, this, I would call it borderline sportsmanship sort of behavior, or maybe bad sportsmanship type of behavior, depending on how you look at it, but yet it's tolerated. Maybe it's even considered part of the game. I'll mention a few and just kind of get your take on this to think about how you handle this or how you would handle it if you're dealing with a 12-year-old, a 16-year-old, or a 22-year-old guy that's getting paid. So some of these guys get up to hit, and they hit one. It's a shot, and then they flip their bat because they know it's a shot. A display of celebration or coolness because they hit the middle of the baseball, and it went somewhere. And the flip of the bat, in my opinion, is a disrespect to the game.
Yeah, so game's changed. when I take it from a kid perspective, when I was growing up, you saw people on TV and you wanted to do what they did. I wanted to be Joaquin Andujar. Like, he put his hands over his head and he had a big leg kick and it looked cool. And then Dan Quisenberry, who was a submarine pitcher, that looked kind of cool. So I was a submarine pitcher for a while.
But and, that you know, is so, part yeah, so of you know, a strategy in terms of deception.
Right. So I'll get to it. But like, I look at it from when I was growing up. Like, I wanted to be Ricky Henderson for a while, and I crouched really low. Well, all of a sudden, I'm 6'1". I can't be Ricky Henderson, right? It's like, so, and I wasn't that fast. So, they see now what players are doing. So, I'm not faulting kids because they're seeing right, they're seeing either. Their major leaguers, you know, bat flip and things of that nature, and second base celebrations and home mm-hmm. run celebrations and everything. And but it's now as accepted. So, as a manager professionally, the manager on the other team, if we have the understanding now, and in the Pioneer League, in the, this is like an A-ball level league, there's certain things we're going to accept. We're going to accept the fact that if a guy gets on second, he's going to do something. He's going to do a leg kick. He's going to do, you know, wheels up. He's going to do something to celebrate that he just hit a double or he stole second base or something. They're going to get in the dugout after a home run, and they're going to have a celebration. They're going to have, you know, they're going to have, I think the Mariners have like a trident, you know, and some guys, we actually have a championship belt that they built for us last year. We got a new one this year. And the guys come in and they put the belt on and they, you know, they do their thing and they, I get it. You know, we had a guy who yelled on Tuesday, he thought he hit a home run on the opposing team and it was a fly out to right. And it's like their whole team's yelling, screaming, he's yelling. And it's like, dude, it's a fly out.
Yeah.
Like then you look, it's embarrassing. But the thing is this, it's more widely accepted. Back when I was playing, if you did something like that, you're going to get drilled next at bat.
Mm-hmm.
But now it's just, I mean, social media has absolutely changed everything. Everyone wants to build their brand. You got college kids that are making millions of dollars, which is crazy. But good for them.
Mm-hmm.
You have people that want to build their own brand of who they are. And now it's one of those things like you're not going to go backwards.
So you basically put this in the category of building your brand by the way you celebrate. I can see your point on this. Right. Okay. So,
and the excessiveness is where it goes again. So before there was no celebration. When you celebrated, it was out of hand. Now there's celebration, but we all know a certain point where that's gone too far. You're being disrespectful, and or let's say you're doing it and you bat flip and you look at our dugout and you throw an F-bomb at us and say this or that, or you're screaming at the pitcher. Like, then you're going to get, something's going to happen.
If so, you're down 8-1 though, and you flip your bat,
you look ridiculous.
Solo home run,
sure.
That's an embarrassment, in my opinion,
to you
and your brand.
Yeah, it's an embarrassment to you.
Yes.
So I look at it this way as just like, all right, well, we're just going to get you out next time. Like, yeah. I'm not a person that's vengeful. I mean, I look at it like, I've been on this earth long enough to know that life's too short. So for me, it's like, we'll get you a different way. We're going to get you. I want to get you out because you know what's important to me? I don't want to give you 90 feet and put you on first base. I want to get you out because when we get you out more often and we score more runs than you, then at the end of the day, we're victorious. And that's what matters
okay,
to me.
Okay, so how old are your kids?
16, 14.
16 and 14. Okay, they're becoming men and they're in the process. I'm sure they, I don't know where they're at in that process. We're all, you know, we all age different, but you're riding home from a game and they've done that, or that you've seen something that was excessive or off-brand for what, you know, off-brand, let's call it, because you're down 7-1 and you flip the, you know, flip the bat and you're, you know, over celebrating when you're getting your butt kicked, or just something that you see is maybe accepted at the bigs, but maybe I don't really want that for my child, or I want to be able to have a conversation about that activity to help develop that my son. What do you say? How does that conversation, what does that look like?
Before I get to that, I'll say this, is that one of the worst times to speak to your child is on the way home from a game.
I'm not laughing because I've done that. So I'm laughing at myself.
Like, what I tell the boys is this: on the way home, especially if it's a long ride home, let's say 20 minutes or more, I say, hey, you want to talk about the game today? No, I'm good. Okay. Well, if you do, I'm here. Because what some parents do is they don't always bring up the good. They bring up, like, the kid could have gone 3 for 5 with 2 doubles and a single, and they talk about how he punched out in the 5th and how he popped out in the 7th.
Right. Or how he over-celebrated and you're down to the negative stuff.
Right. So it's like, for one, let your kid talk about, be always open and say, hey, the door's always open. Like, if you want to talk about it, just let me know. Number two, if something like that happens, I'll bring it up and just say, how'd you feel about that? Because for me, I think asking questions is really important. Like, for me to go in there and say, hey, you know what? When Bobby threw his bat up, when we're down 7-1 and threw his bat, that was garbage. That was stupid. I would prefer to sit there and ask them what their opinion is, because they already know my opinion. So instead of, and I don't want their opinion to be maybe skewed by what I'm saying. Because it's like, oh, I respect my dad. So if dad says it's bad, then it's bad. They already know how I think about it. But if I ask them, so what do you think about that situation? Yeah, that was pretty dumb. I was like, well, yeah, I mean, just make sure that's not how we do things. So for me, I love to ask questions because I already know what my answer is. And in my family, we're, again, I'm a Christian who coaches baseball, not a baseball coach who's a Christian. So they all know what my identity is and who I am as a person. And we try to build them from the ground up. It's like building a house, right? We want to build a solid foundation in our kids' lives. So we're very fortunate that they are respectful on the playing fields. But what I love about Connor and Bryce is that they have an edge. Because they're growing up, even though we live in Scottsdale, which is, and we're in a very modest, you know, blue collar home, but you have mansions down the road, and there's a lot of money, and those people are great people. They just have more money than I do, but they're being very much raised in a very a very blue collar, down to earth, understanding home, where it's like, hey, you know, I want you. You get punched in the mouth, I want you to punch back. I want you to be out there and be a dog. Like, and they're dogs on the field, but they're not disrespectful. Like, they have that edge where they want to go out there, they're going to hold their teammates accountable, and they're going to work really hard, and they're not going to celebrate. But if somebody pushes them, they're going to push back. Mm-hmm. And they're going to have that edge where, hey, I'm going to come out. And like, when I played, I wanted to impose my will upon you. And as I coach and I manage now, we are going to play fast. We're going to play downhill. We're going to throw strikes. We're going to play defense, and we're going to hit situationally, and we're going to impose our will upon you, and you're going to feel us. You're going to feel the heat of our team, and if you're going to beat us, you're going to beat us by scoring one more run than us, but we're not going to bow down to anything. And I want them to have that without being disrespectful to the game. So I'm thankful to have two boys that do that in our own home. But to get back to your point, yeah, I'd ask questions and ask them what they thought about it and then have a conversation. And then I might say, yeah, I agree. That was dumb. Like, we don't do that kind of stuff. And he better watch out, because if we play that team again, you don't know. That coach might be old school and he might throw something at his ribs. And by the way, if you do that in your high school coach, then you're an idiot.
Okay, so I want to dive a little bit deeper into some of these topics around sportsmanship, or some of these sort of issues in my mind. So when you bring up Buster Posey, I'm a fan. I've got his shirt is my on my back of my desk chair over there as the seat cover, because I respect him for a lot of reasons. He was you know, a tremendous baseball player, but the way that he carried himself, being sort of old school professional, you know, play the game the way that it's supposed to be played. I love that aspect of his approach to the game. And I see that in many, many players, but you don't see it with every player. And so I sort of wonder about some of these old school traditions, and I wonder where maybe you sit on these, and do they still exist in the game? You brought up the idea that you might throw inside or plunk somebody if they disrespect you, and it's sort of the pitchers tend to have a little bit of a license to retaliate for bad sportsmanship on the other end. How do you deal with that sort of old school sort of expectation that might be presented upon a player or upon a team to retaliate?
Yeah. So one thing I will never do is I will never tell a pitcher to do something like that. He's a grown man, and if he takes it into his own hands, that's something that I'm never going to encourage and never going to tell someone to do. You know, there was a little bit of a beanball war, I think, last night with the Giants and the Padres. Mm-hmm. You know, it went to, it wasn't Machado, I think it was Tatis got one in the hand, and then what seemed to be a retaliation to Ohtani. So Ohtani, I mean, he's just built different. Like, he's waving his players off, his teammates. He's like, mm-hmm. forget about it, don't worry about it. Like, he's a pretty phenomenal human being, and I don't know him personally. I only met Buster very few times in the minor leagues when he was already in the big leagues, and he seemed to be that quiet leader. I was around Brandon Crawford a lot more. I got to hit with him quite a few times in the minor league when he was up in the majors, but he would come and work out the minor league in the off season, and he was just that really quiet, like, presence. He was just so calm. Like, it was like you want to be with that dude on the battlefield. Like, he was so calm under pressure, it seemed like. And I feel like Buster was the same way. I think that's why he's going to be a great president of the team.
My wife always loved Brandon Crawford. I had to tease her. That's her boyfriend. You know, I didn't realize what his personality was like. She's just talking about, I love the way that he played the game. She liked to, you know, she liked his hair and all that.
He had good flow. He's got good cabbage. But his pulse was so low whenever you were around him. It's like, I mean, and that makes a really good player. I'm going back to my son, but Connor, like, his pulse is so low that I wish I played like this. I didn't play like that. My hair was on fire when I played. So, like,
Giants restrained themselves last night. I watched that game. So the Giants restrained
it was the Dodgers.
You're talking about sorry.
Yeah.
There was a little bit of, my mind was on the Giants game. And there was a little bit of, back and forth on that last night. And so that's where my head was. But the restraint, are we celebrating the restraint at all?
I think what we look at is this, is that there are going to be people in the game that are going to look at it as disrespectful. Or, hey, you're putting, one thing you can never do is that if you're going to do it to somebody, you want to try to find a fleshy area. Like, we don't go somewhere where we're going to, you know, if you're going to somehow take away his job to feed his family, that's garbage, disrespectful. Yeah. And you don't do stuff like that. That was done way back in the day. And guys didn't even have helmets back then. Like, the game's different. Guys are hanging out now. Guys are all friends. I remember I was so mad one year in Billings. I was like, and I was really angry. I don't cuss very often, but I think I cussed that day. I was like, everybody's friends. I used an expletive. And I was like, we just got our butts kicked and you guys are out there hanging out after the game. Like, it's everyone's friendly now. So, for me, there's going to be times where guys are taking their own hands. They're going to retaliate. They're going to do things that are a bit old school. I think to be a next level coach, you have to have that feel. You have to have, as a player, you have to take analytics and use the data for what it's worth, because this is not rotisserie baseball. Okay, with as human beings, you have to have feel as a hitting coach on how to use those numbers, or as a pitching coach, use those numbers to help develop your players. To dumb it down to a very, very small degree, a T is a tool to help develop a hitter. So are the analytics, right? So using that as a development piece, there's a great book called The MVP Machine that my buddy Nate Fryman, who is a hitting coordinator with the Cleveland Guardians, he's in the book because he was a major league player who also now knows all the analytics and helps, you know, bring that into the game. And but he was there. So it's like you got to be a person who can blend having feel for the game, knowing how hard it is to play the game because you've been there, and then you've coached the game, but then also take the numbers and bring them together and say, hey, here's how these numbers can help you become a better hitter. So I know we're going a little bit off track of what you talked about, but yeah, for me, you have to have that old school mentality with a new school method to be a great, I think, president, general manager, to be a great farm director, to be a great manager, to be a great coach, to be a great player, to blend all that, because I don't think you're going to be successful being completely old school. I don't think you're going to be successful being totally new school. I don't believe it's going to work.
Okay, so especially at the major league level, your job is to win games. Your job is to put butts in seat, win games, things like that. It's a business. I get that. So when a manager storms the home plate umpire and gets in his face and yells at him until he gets kicked out of the game, when is that a good decision? And are there times when you do that because that's going to inspire your team, that's going to inspire the fans, that's going to change the next call with the umpire? When is it a good decision to demonstrate that?
It's a fine line. You know, for me, I want to represent who I am and my identity when I'm out there. So again, I'm not the cuss police. There's only two words that I don't say and I don't agree with, are GDs and JCs. So people know what that means. It's disrespectful. But for me is like, I try not to do any of that, any kind of cussing whatsoever, because I don't want to disrespect another human being. Umpires are human beings. I don't want to have robots running this game anyway. I don't want to have machines running. I mean, they're going to make mistakes. Sometimes you go out there because you want your player to stay in the game. So you intercede before he gets kicked out, and you get in there and you have to say whatever you got to say. And sometimes what you say, some magic words to get you thrown out so that guy doesn't. Sometimes your guy gets thrown out, and then you got to go out there and defend what he is so your players know. So at a certain point too, like, just because I don't get kicked out, I've only got kicked out once, you know, in 23 and 24. And I don't do it because, I mean, I tell my players, listen, I need to stay in the game because it's important that I'm here to help lead you guys and to help make decisions. I trust my staff, but I don't want to get kicked out, right? So there's many times where I'm going to go out there, I'm going to give them a piece of my mind, but if I don't get thrown out, it's not, don't look at it as, oh, he doesn't have my back. I'm just trying to stay in the game so I can help us win a baseball game, right? There are going to be times where managers are going to be, hey, listen, I just got to go. You know, yeah. I just got to go because, and again, like it happened to me, you know, the fans, I was walking out because where our stadium is in Marysville, I had to walk, you know, actually through the stands to get to the clubhouse, and they were high-fiving me, and umpires had a bad night,
yeah,
you know, and I called them out. I didn't cuss, but I called them out, and then they had to toss me, but, you know, our team responded with, I don't know, 10 runs in the next four or five innings, and did I inspire them? I don't know. Were the fans, you know, I'll do a little bit more at home than I will on the road. And sometimes I'll even go to the umpire, I'll give him a wink and I'm like, hey, just give me a minute. Mm-hmm. And I won't be disrespectful to him, but I'm like, just give me a second. Like, we're at home right now. I think you blew this call. I'm not going to cuss you out, but I'm going to go ahead and just give you peace of my mind. And I'm going to walk away, and they're going to cheer, and we're going to walk, and we're going to go our separate ways, and we'll talk about it tomorrow. So like,
It does happen.
Yeah, yeah. It does happen. You know, sometimes I go out there because, and it was funny, as I went out there one time in 23 in Billings, and the guy was like, hey, you come out here. I was like, for the fans, like, no, that was a really bad call. I'm like, that was really, really bad. I'm out here because you stunk on that call. But yeah, there's going to be times you have to defend your players. You got to be out there for them. And you know, sometimes a ball club, it's like, hey, you're going to get fined $100, or maybe it's a lot more in the big leagues. I don't know. I've never been a big league coach. I wouldn't know. It'd be great to find out someday. Sometimes the team's like, hey, you know what? You did your job. Like, we're going to go ahead and pay that. Or, you know, we're going to donate that money to charity. Don't worry about it coming out of your paycheck, kind of a deal.
All right. So we only have a couple minutes left. So I'm just going to kind of let you sort of wrap up with anything I didn't ask you that you think would be good messaging for people who desire to win, that need to tap into that desire and figure out a way to win. And it might be an entrepreneur. It might be a person that wants to become a better baseball player, better football player. Maybe somebody wants to become a better dad. Share us maybe some final thoughts.
Sure. Mission statement. I know it gets kind of thrown around, but keeping something very, very simple. So we have team rules for our team. And we've got a gigantic grease board that's, I don't know, maybe it's 4 foot long by 4 foot high. So it's pretty big. And I've got a little sticky note. And the team rules are in the corner. And I do it for a purpose. I've got all this other stuff all over there, but team rules, and there's a little sticky note. And I got the idea from Bob Brenly, who was, when I was with the D-backs in 01, he was the manager. I wasn't in spring training when this happened, but the story was is that he wrote the team rules on a cocktail napkin. And first day of spring training, he had a veteran team with like Matt Williams and Jay Bell and Kurt Schilling and Randy Johnson. He knew that they'd please themselves. But his little cocktail napkin, and he picked it up and said, these are the team rules, guys. Go out and get them, right? So that's all you got to do. So I took that, and I'm like, I probably had ADHD. I'm the youngest of a family, of a blue-collar family in West Branch, Michigan. We couldn't pay for that kind of stuff. So I was just hyperactive, right? But I know I need to have things small and condensed. Too much input, it blows me up, right? So we have our team rules, and it's an acronym called RATE. It's how you rate yourself every day. Respect, accountability, timeliness, excellence. Respect everyone around you, including yourself. Hold yourself and your teammates accountable. Be on time. Shoot for excellence. When you shoot for excellence and you miss, you're great. When you miss great, you're good. You miss good, you're average. But average people aren't usually successful. So we are going to shoot for excellence, and we have that margin for error to get down to great, to get to good, right? So I encourage people to not have a gigantic, long, two-paragraph mission statement or have a big, long list of rules. Keep it very simple. Look at those 10 rules you have. Can you turn those into 4? Can you turn them into 3? Can you combine them? Can you make it something small where they can just focus on certain things? Because when you have only a few things to focus on and to think about, I believe you're more successful. And also that even if it's in the book today, again, I know I'm going back to it, but it talks about the subtitle is Turning Your Passion into Your Profession. And it's, I believe that you are more successful at what you do when you're passionate about what you do. And so if you're a young person right now, or you're a person transitioning into a new role, or you want to transition, like, what are you really passionate about? What do you really want to do? How do you want to make a difference? And can you do that for a career? So I encourage people to focus on things like, when I focused on real estate and baseball, I was not very good, and I tanked in real estate, and I knew I should have just stayed just in baseball, right? Would have saved me a lot of heartache and a lot of money. So for me, focus on what you're good at and then work really, really hard at that one thing and keep it really simple. And, you know, so for me, it's worked out to where now having that Cactus Athletics company, it's smaller version of what it used to be, but it's still there. Knowing that God put it on my heart to write more. So the website, billyhorton.com, where every month I'm writing an article that's tailored towards men, tailored towards how hard life is, tailored towards, you know, winning, like you're talking about, and doing that. And then having the opportunity for people to go out and say, hey, you know what, this can help you, inspire you to be better at something. So, you know, for me, it's just about being an encouragement. I want to be a good example. I'm a person who makes tons of mistakes. I make mistakes every day. When I make mistakes, sometimes I have to go to my wife and apologize, or my kids and apologize and do that. But I try to work and be humble. So if we can just be better people, like how can I serve? How can I be a servant leader? How can I serve others? Because when you focus on other people, they tend to help you. So instead of being selfish and focusing on just me, which is kind of what society's telling us to do, why don't you flip the script and why don't you focus on other people and see how that works for you?
Love it. Billy Horton, billyhorton.com. Words of wisdom, a lot of success sharing with our audience today. Really appreciate you, Billy.
I loved it. Thank you so much.
Thank you. and to all you out there fighting the good fight for entrepreneurship and for the backyard advantage, and of course, all of you out there fighting the good fight for our freedom, our security, and our way of life. Here at Haney Biz, the Mark Haney Show, and the Growth Factory, we're never above you, we're never below you, always by your side.
This segment includes the personal knowledge, experiences, and opinions about angel investing by seasoned angel investors. This content is for informational purposes only and should not be considered as legal, tax, investment, or financial advice. Nothing in this segment constitutes a solicitation, recommendation, or endorsement.